Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, if everyone's got their yantra together there. Yesterday, text 29 and 30 and 31 a bit, but mainly 29. Let us go back, let's go to 30. Perhaps we can recite 30 responsively. Venum quanantam aravinda dalaya taksham. Well, now listen, devotees, let's just do it the way we've been doing it, all right? Responsively. You've heard us the term used before? Venum quanantam aravinda dalaya taksham. Barharvatam samasitam buddhasundarangam. Kandarpa koti kamaniya vishesha shobham. Govindam adi purusham tamaham bhajami. I worship Govinda, the primeval lord, who's adept in playing on his flute, with blooming eyes like lotus petals, with head decked with peacock's feather, with the figure of beauty tinged with the hue of blue clouds, and his unique loveliness charming millions of cupids. And 31 he says, I worship Govinda, the primeval lord, round whose neck is swinging a garland of flowers, beautified with the moon locket, whose two hands are adorned with the flute and jeweled ornaments, who always revels in pastimes of love, whose graceful threefold bending form of Shamsunda is eternally manifest. So we noted yesterday how in the purport of text 31, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says that the verse, 29, which we did yesterday, Chintamani, Prakara Satmasu Kalpa Vriksha, where are we? The transcendental region and spiritual names of Govinda are brought out. Then in text 30, Venum Quanantam, the eternal beautiful form of Govinda is described. And then in 31, Krishna's amorous pastimes are indicated. They're basically indicated. Some of these things, actually particularly what is discussed, what is mentioned in verse 31. When we come to verse 37, they are going to be elaborated on in a mighty 12-page purport, yes, which is discussing many of these things and particularly about his pastimes. So some of these things then that are mentioned here in these two verses, they are going to be discussed in text 37 in the purport particularly the pastimes and how Krishna is conducting those pastimes. So perhaps we won't go into it so much now. So 30 then is about the beauty and 31 about the pastimes. Krishna, actually in both verses, it's interesting, in both verses, 30 and 31, it mentions how he's playing the flute. In 30, it's Venu, and 31, Vamsi. So in both verses, so we can take it that this is very important in terms of Krishna's attractiveness, his beauty, because his playing of the flute, his expertise in that way, it's part of his beauty, and it's certainly part of his pastimes. And Krishna has different flutes. One of them, one type is called Venu, another is called Vansi. I don't know how much you know about Krishna's flutes. Any of you note what sort of flute Krishna Shamsunda has in his hand today? Well, I made a point of looking because I knew we were going to bring it up. Anyway, I think that today, I mean, you could check it. I think he has Vansi. You know how you can tell Vansi? Vansi is normally 15 inches long and has 9 holes. As opposed to Venu. You know what Venu is like? Venu is normally not more than 6 inches long. So it's very small and has 6 holes. And then there's Murali, 18 inches long, with 1 hole at the end for blowing in, and then 4 holes towards the other end for the tune. And then there are variations. That Murali, that longest flute, is very enchanting, particularly enchanting. So maybe Shamsunda has that sort of flute today. There are different types of these flutes. Mahananda, Akarshini. When Vansi gets longer, he is known as Mahananda. When he gets even longer, he's known as Akarshini. When he's even longer, then he's called Vangshuli. And the cowherd boys particularly like that. Sometimes these flutes are made of bamboo, sometimes of marble, sometimes of jewels, sometimes of gold. So anyway, the thing is that these flutes are very special, and they're very special characteristic of Krishna, how he plays on the flutes. That when he plays on the flutes, then the demigods and birds tremble. Unconscious and lifeless things tremble. Cows become stunned in ecstasy, and they stop chewing their cud, and they look like painted pictures. Just suspended animation altogether. Water, like the Yamuna, becomes stunned. The Yamuna stands there, Srila Prabhupada describes this. The Yamuna just stands there when she hears the flute, and she's waiting. She's not moving because she's waiting to catch some dust, knowing that Krishna's nearby. Some dust may be in the air. So the Yamuna stops, hoping to get some of that dust. Sometimes if Krishna takes the cows on a hill which has no river, and if it's a hot day, sometimes Krishna plays his flute in such a way as to make part of the hill melt, and then the cows can drink the melted hill. Yes. Sometimes Krishna calls the cows by name with his flute. Yes, it's not just a matter of making sounds, you know, like musical tones, but actual words can come out of the flute. And what's an example of that? Can you think of an example, Mother Vishakha Priya? Yeah, the second of these Gayatri mantras, as illustrated on the cover of Brahma Samhita, Krishna's playing the flute in a very tantalizing way, and Brahma is hearing it and then trying to reproduce it outside of his mouth, through his mouths, and it comes out as this, the last of our Gayatri mantras. Klim Kamadevaya Vidmehe Pushpa Banaya Dimahi Tano Nanga Prachodayat. Yeah, so sometimes he calls the cows by name with his flute. Sometimes when it's hot in the summer, Krishna plays his flute and it forms a cloud which rains. So the cows are able to drink and get cooled. Sometimes he's standing on a rock and he plays his flute and the rock melts, leaving a footprint. There are a number of rocks around Vrindavan area which have Krishna's footprint, or they're meant to have. I mean, anyway, you know, a very interesting one which I have personally witnessed with my own eyes is the one at Radha Damodar, which is the one supposedly given by Krishna to Sanatana Goswami when he got too old to continue with his practice of daily Govardhan Parikrama. However, when you go to the Radha Damodar temple in Jaipur, which has the original Radha Damodar actually, hand-carved by Srila Rupa Goswami, very small little Radha Krishna deities, they also have a Govardhan Shila, which is more or less identical. I don't think they quickly shipped it from Vrindavan to Jaipur. So I think this is just part of their Sankirtan program. Yes. Because Prabhupada did say some devotees were here back in the early days of ISKCON, and they went to one of these so-called Goswami temples, and they were, you know, conducting themselves very nicely and respectfully. And the so-called Goswami said that, "You're such nice boys. If you carry on like this, you can worship these deities in your next life." And they went back and told Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, "Well, what did you say?" And they said, "Well, we didn't really say anything." Prabhupada said, "You should have told them that if you carry on worshipping your deities so nicely, you can take birth in ISKCON in your next lifetime." So I think some of these people may become Sankirtan devotees in their next lifetimes. You can see some of them, when you meet them out there, they're really into it. They're really into it. I don't know if you've met any of the real professionals yet, but... Okay, anyway, back to the flute. So sometimes the rock melts and Krishna's foot is left imprinted there. Sometimes Krishna plays his flute and the river Yamuna becomes stunned and the cows and cowherd boys can walk across. Yes, very, very convenient. And sometimes Krishna makes his flute into a boat and ferries all the cows and cowherd boys across. Now that must be quite something. So this flute is very important and very dear to Krishna. And Krishna, of course, is always blowing on the flute with his very sweet lotus lips, which the gopis are always hankering to kiss, in order to please Krishna, of course, not just because they're, you know, feeling lusty in the so-called normal material way. But sometimes the gopis get very jealous of this flute. This is described in, I think it's Nectar of Devotion or the Krishna book, one of the two or both, that sometimes the flute looks at the gopis. And because the flute is living, the flute is not some inanimate piece of metal or bamboo, something like that. No. Actually, Krishna's flute, his Vamsi flute, incarnated in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes as Vamsi Vadan Thakur, and he was a full-scale human being. Yes. Yes. And a very close personal associate of Mother Sachi. Anyway, the flute sometimes looks at the gopis and sees how they are just burning in transcendental envy, because the flute is always tasting the nectar of Krishna's lips. And the flute sometimes then laughs at them and says that, you gopis, you think you're expert in tasting Krishna's lips, but you don't know about these things. But me, oh, I know so much. So this flute, these flutes are definitely very special persons. So they're mentioned in both of these verses as being part of Krishna's beauty and an essential part of Krishna's pastimes. So I think due to lack of time, we will now just move along to the next group of verses. Some of these things, as I said, are going to be discussed further when we reach text 37. We will now go on to texts 32 to 35. They form a natural group. And you'll see that, I don't know, maybe I pointed out even, how Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says that. And Jiva Goswami's commentary on Brahma Samhita, he also makes the same point, that these four verses form a natural group. Okay, I'll just read the translations. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, whose transcendental form is full of bliss, truth, substantiality, and is thus full of the most dazzling splendor. Each of the limbs of that transcendental figure possesses in himself the full-fledged functions of all the organs, and eternally sees, maintains, and manifests the infinite universes, both spiritual and mundane. What demonstration have we seen already of this fact about the interchangeability of the organs and limbs and so on, bodily parts? We have already seen in the preceding verses a very important example. The glance of Mahavishnu. With his glance, he impregnated the living entities into material nature. With his glance, normally if you want to manipulate something, change something, you have to use your hands. He glanced, and he manipulated the pradhan in such a way that it became mahatattva. So already we've seen a very clear example of this interchangeability of organs and bodily parts. Text 33. I worship Govinda. Well, actually, just before we read that, let me just bring our attention back to the point which Srila Bhaktisiddhanta makes towards the beginning of the purport of text 32, which is explaining how these four verses are linked together. So he says that starting right at the beginning of the purport, actually, of 32, for want of a taste of things spiritual, a grave doubt arises in the minds of those who are enchained by worldly knowledge. So people who are just materially entangled, they will get some doubt. When? How will this doubt arise? Having heard these first three verses. Having heard these first three verses about the beauty of Krishna, his eternal pastimes, and all these incredible features of his, some doubt may arise that how is this possible? How could this be a reality in the minds of materialistic people? On hearing a narration of the pastimes of Krishna, they think that the truth regarding Krishna, quote-unquote truth in this context, is the mental concoction of certain learned scholars. Yes, they think that some devotees got very fired up and started glorifying Krishna and went a bit overboard. Yeah. That even though Krishna's very nice, he's not that nice. You know, like in the fairy tales where it always says they all lived happily ever after. Right? Well, none of them lived happily ever after, actually. Because it's all fictitious. So some of these scholars may think, some of these materialistic people may think, that these statements about Krishna and his eternal pastimes and being so beautiful he can attract Cupid and so on and so forth, that these are some enthusiastic devotees who have got carried away and have made these excessively colorful descriptions of Krishna. Created by the imaginative brains out of material drawn from the mundane principles. With the object of removing this harmful doubt, Brahma, in this and the three following shlokas, after distinguishing between two things, spirit and matter, in a rational way, has tried to make one understand the pure lila of Krishna obtained by his unmixed ecstatic trance. So in this verse 32 then, and the following three verses which we'll read now, Lord Brahma is trying to mention, explain, point out certain factors, different aspects in Krishna's nature, which makes these things possible, like eternal pastimes and this astonishing, incomparable beauty, and so on and so forth. You know, some of the things he does in his pastimes, which of course are not elaborated upon in text 31, but they're indicated. They're indicated. And our acharyas in their, particularly Bhagavatam commentaries, and so many commentaries actually, they make the point that in many verses in Shastra, some person says something. Like, in the case of verse 31, the pastimes are mentioned. But we should understand that because they're mentioned, they're there. The pastimes are there. So the understanding is that on hearing the pastimes referred to in text 31, these people may become confused. So therefore, in these verses 32 to 35, Lord Brahma is going to explain certain facts about Krishna, which if you catch hold of them, then you'll understand, oh yes, I guess he can do those things then. I guess he could be like that. You follow the idea? So let's just go on to text 33. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is inaccessible to the Vedas, but obtainable by pure unalloyed devotion of the soul, who is without a second, who is not subject to decay, who is without a beginning, whose form is endless, who is the beginning and the eternal Purusha. Yet, he is a person possessing the beauty of blooming youth. 34. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord. Only the tip of the toe of whose lotus feet is approached by the yogis who aspire after the transcendental and betake themselves to pranayama by drilling the respiration, or by the jnanis who try to find out the non-differentiated Brahman by the process of elimination of the mundane extending over thousands of millions of years. These are the people you may recall. Do you recall in what context these people were mentioned already? They're the ones who end up on the tridents. Right. Yes, they get into serious trouble on the tridents. And they fall back. Yeah. So they can only approach the tip of the toe, and even then they can't really. The tridents get them. And they fall back down. And text 35. Therefore, on the basis of all this, this is how Jiva Goswami explains it, that therefore, on the basis of what we just read in 32, 33, and 34, he is an undifferentiated entity, as there is no distinction between the potency and the possessor thereof. In his work of creation of millions of worlds, his potency remains inseparable. All the universes exist in him, and he is present in his fullness in every one of the atoms. that are scattered throughout the universe at one and the same time. Such is the primeval Lord whom I adore. So when you hear these things, then the idea is Lord Brahma is mentioning these things so that if you are confused, how could Krishna do different things in his pastimes, transcendental things? When you hear these descriptions, then you should, if you accept them at least, then you should understand, oh yes, now I know how he can do those things in his pastimes. Like the Damodar Leela. We've written this verse on these two verses actually on the board here. They're related, they're part of the Damodar Leela. They appear there in the Bhagavatam in the course of the Damodar Leela. And there, let me just get it out quickly. There, it said, the translation of these two verses is, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is no beginning and no end, no exterior and no interior, no front and no rear. In other words, he's all-pervading. Because he's not under the influence of the element of time, for him there's no difference between past, present, and future. He exists in his own transcendental form at all times. Being absolute, beyond relativity, he is free from distinctions between cause and effect, although he is the cause and effect of everything. That unmanifested person, who is beyond the perception of the senses, had now appeared as a human child, and Mother Yashoda, considering him her ordinary child, bound him to the wooden mortar with a rope. So this is an example of the pastimes, which these skeptical people, when they hear that Lord, that Mother Yashoda tried to tie Krishna up with one piece of rope, then two, and three, and four, and finally many, many, they went for a long way, many kilometers of rope, but couldn't get around Krishna once, then the skeptic may think, rubbish. You know, this is a fairy tale. But these verses, from the Bhagavatam, and these Brahma Samhita verses, which we just went through, are trying to establish the principles behind how, in the pastimes, these fantastic things can happen. How, you know, that many kilometers of rope are not enough. But finally, in the end, you know, even a piece of rope 1 inch long would have been enough. Yes. Not that it had to be, you know, like a meter long, perhaps, to get around him. Not that it had to be 10 kilometers long. But even 1 inch long would have been enough. Because of the principle which is mentioned in the second of these verses from Brahma Samhita, Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Atma Bhakto. When the element of bhakti is there, then these impossible considerations become possible. I'd just like to bring it out in regard to these two verses which we wrote on the board, because, you know, it's a very good example, and Jiva Goswami gives a very interesting explanation in the form of a debate between an imaginary skeptic and himself as to how this Damodar Leela could have happened in the way it did. So just try and listen to this. The phrase Jagach Chaya, that is in the second line, the way it's written at the end, you see? Jagato yo jagach chaya, which means, he is everything in the creation in total. This may be understood in the following way. The Supreme Personality is not different from either the cause of the creation or the cosmic manifestation that is the effect of the cause. In other words, because the entire material universe is nothing but the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, He is not different from it. Just like the fire, situated on one side of the room, is not different from the heat generated by it, which may be felt on the other side of the room. Because in a certain sense, there's no difference between cause and effect. And the effect simply embodies the cause. And the cause has the effect embodied within it to start off with. This is a little bit of a Chintya Beda Beda Tattva. Hope it doesn't sound like double Dutch. Anyway, he's not different from it. Because an ordinary material rope is simply a fragmental part of one of his material energies, such a rope has no power to bind him, any more than a small flame has the power to burn a large fire. So now begins the debate. At this point, someone may raise the following objection. If the Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-pervading, got it, if He's all-pervading, then how is it possible that Mother Yashoda tied Him with a small rope that could not even have extended across this one universe? If He is all-pervading, means beyond this universe, through the spiritual manifestation and everywhere. But that rope could not have even extended across the whole of this universe. I mean, what to speak of that? It was only a few kilometers long. So if He's all-pervading, how could have He been tied by that rope? This objection is answered in this verse by the word Martya Lingam. Can you see Martya Lingam? Right. Which means that in order to perform His pastimes, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared like an ordinary human being. In order to act like an ordinary human being, the Supreme Lord allowed Himself to be bound by Mother Yashoda's rope, even though He's all-pervading. At this point, the person may raise the following question. If the Supreme Personality of Godhead has a human-like form, then that form is certainly manifested within a limited area of space. How can such a limited form be all-pervading? Caught you, right? No. No. This question is answered by the use of the word adhoksajam, beyond the perception of the senses. The form of the Personality of Godhead cannot be properly understood by the senses of the conditioned soul, nor can it be understood by any other process for acquiring knowledge available to the conditioned souls, like reading the Vedas or becoming yogis. Because He is thus inconceivable, although He may appear to be limited within time and space, in actual fact He's all-pervading, which is why the rope couldn't get around Him to start off with. But because Martya Lingam, because He's playing like a human, therefore the rope could get around Him. Because He's thus inconceivable, because He's not properly understood by ordinary living entities, He's therefore described in this verse as avyaktam. That word is also there. Unmanifest to the ordinary conditioned souls. At this point, the person may ask, he doesn't give up easily, this imaginary skeptic, if the Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-pervading, even though His form appears like that of an ordinary human being, then why did he not reveal his all-pervading nature to his mother, Yashoda? Why not? This question is answered by the words, Matvatmajam, which are also there somewhere. Yes, in the third line, beginning of the third line. Matvatmajam, that Mother Yashoda considered Krishna her own ordinary child. The relationship between Krishna and Mother Yashoda was that of son and mother. In order not to disrupt the blissful exchange of love between himself and his mother, Lord Krishna concealed his all-pervasiveness and his other opulences from her eyes. Mother Yashoda's ignorance of the superhuman prowess of son was actually her great glory. For in order to keep the loving parent-child relationship with her, he allowed himself to be bound by a few small ropes. So this is an example which is illustrating what is being discussed in these four verses here in Brahma Samhita. And Jiva Goswami is very kindly explaining how all these things, once you understand Krishna is like this, Matvatmajam, then you can understand why he doesn't reveal to Mother Yashoda that actually is all pervading and, you know, don't get into too much anxiety about trying to tie me up and correct me, because I don't really need to be corrected. Thank you. Because I'm God. So it's okay. Don't worry. But actually it's her glory. And it's the glory of the spiritual pastimes and the love of the devotees. And ultimately it's the glory of Krishna that within his pastimes these contradictory things happen. But in terms of certain capacities within which he has within himself, because he's the Supreme Lord, but he uses them to enhance his loving pastimes. So, of course, another very good example you may be familiar with is Narada Muni and the cobbler. You know that story. You're all familiar with that story? Yeah, there was the cobbler and the Brahmin. Brahmin was very puffed up. Cobbler was a humble devotee. Narada Muni asked Lord Narayan how long it would take the two of them to go back to Godhead. Lord Narayan said, well, that Brahman, he's so puffed up that I, even though I'm God, I don't know when he's coming back to Godhead. He's just too much. But that humble cobbler, he's coming back at the end of this life. And he told Narada that if you want to understand why it's like that, then when you meet them again, you tell them both that when you saw me, I was busy thrilling an elephant through the eye of a needle. See how they react. Then you'll understand how it is that, you know, their futures will be like they will. So Narada did that, and the Brahmin was very upset when he heard that Lord Narayan said that even though he's the Supreme Lord, he didn't know when he was going back to Godhead. And then when Narada said, well, actually, you know, the Lord was busy threading an elephant through the eye of a needle, the Brahmin thought that this is just a lot of nonsense. This is impossible. How can you thread an elephant through the eye of a needle? I don't even think you saw Lord Narayan. You're just trying to con me. So then Narada went and told the cobbler he was very happy. But then Narada said, oh, by the way, when I saw Lord Narayan, he was busy threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. What do you think of that? And the cobbler, he became even more ecstatic. And Narada said, do you really believe me? And the cobbler said, sure, no problem. And he picked up one banyan seed pod, some sort of little thing which banyan trees drop with seeds in them. And he said, within this, there are hundreds of seeds, each one can produce a banyan tree. So in one sense, within this little thing, there are hundreds of huge banyan trees, each one of them bigger than many elephants. So to put an elephant through the eye of a needle, no problem. So we can see that through his bhakti, the cobbler was able to actually understand factually this point. Not just that, oh, we'll accept anything. If you say that Krishna did it, we'll just accept it, whatever it is. You know, that sort of like the blind faith type of idea. No. Because of his bhakti, even though he's a cobbler, and that means he's never been to school, he's probably illiterate. He never read Bhagavad Gita. But because of his bhakti, he actually understands, in fact, how it's working. It's not just that he believes, oh yes, big elephant through the eye of a needle, no problem. No, he understands how it can be real. So in this way, when a person has bhakti, then these contradictory things, achincha bedabe tattva, and tying Krishna with a rope, even though he's all pervading, but not being able to tie him even when he's appearing in this small childish form, even when you've got kilometers of rope, and all these types of things, for the devotee, no problem. No problem. And therefore, when we understand Krishna in these ways, with that key of bhakti, then how verses 29, 30, and 31, particularly 31 with the pastimes, how they can be accepted as being realities. Any comments or questions? Is there a connection between the story of the cobbler, in the story of the cobbler and the Brahmin, and that one devotee in Sri Rangam temple who Lord Chaitanya saw reading Bhagavad Gita upside down because he couldn't read, but he was in great ecstasy? Yes, the principle is the same. Because they have bhakti, because the cobbler had bhakti, he could realize this otherwise impossible thing about putting an elephant through the eye of a needle, but in like concrete terms. Yes, not just blind faith, oh yes, elephant through eye of needle, no problem. But he could understand how it could actually work. So similarly, that devotee who was sitting there looking at the pages of Bhagavad Gita, even upside down sometimes, but crying tears of ecstasy because he realized that Krishna, like the purport in Bhagavad Gita in one sense, is that because Arjuna is a devotee, Krishna is so merciful that he's driving the chariot, he's revealing the truth to him, and, you know, he's doing all these things for Arjuna because Arjuna is a devotee and Krishna is very merciful to his devotees. So he got the realization. Actually, he got that realization not by looking at the pages upside down. He got that realization through looking at the picture on the cover where there's Krishna driving the chariot. The realization came in that way. Yeah. So the principle's the same. Vedeshu dualabham adualabham atma bhakto. The Damodar Leela and that Leela of the Krishna's eating earth, they are related. Krishna is showing his superhuman prowess within his baby form. I don't quite understand the point you're getting at though. He's aware he's the Lord. Well, at that particular time, she contemplated the idea. It wasn't that she became fixed in that consciousness. She contemplated the idea that maybe he's a demigod. Who is he? Maybe he's Narayan? But then she started looking in his eyes And again, the Yogamaya influence came. Matvatmajam. It's specifically described. She looked in his eyes. And when she looked in his eyes, then matvatmajam. Then matva means mother, atmajam means her own. Yeah, from her, born from her body actually. Atmajam. Born from her body. Yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, this is an interesting point. Sometimes the inhabitants of Vrindavan realize that Krishna is God. Oh, yes. They certainly do sometimes. But then they very quickly forget it because they become overwhelmed by their loving sentiments again. Just like that time, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that when Mother Yashoda saw the universe in Krishna's mouth, she saw the same universal form that Arjuna saw. But she didn't become overwhelmed like Arjuna became overwhelmed. She had some realization, wow, maybe he's God. But then she looked in his eyes, and then her love, maternal feeling came out again. So as that happened, as she was going in between the two, from that mood of a certain amount of awe and reverence, back into the purely motherly mood, as she went in between the two, she thought to herself, maybe Krishna's God. Well, isn't that nice? I'm so fortunate to have God as my son. And then she forgot all about it. And sometimes the cowherd boys, when Krishna kills some super demon, the cowherd boys think, wow, how did he do that? Maybe he's God. But then they think, wow, that's really nice. We're so fortunate to have God as our friend. That's really good. And then they forget about it. But when, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, that when Arjuna saw the same universal form that Mother Yashoda saw, because he had less love, yeah, then the Aishvarya realization, if you know what I mean by that, the Aishvarya realization was so stunning and astonishing and overwhelming for Arjuna that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says the experience for him was something like having a heart attack. Total devastation. He ended up on the ground, not knowing what was what. Yeah. But Mother Yashoda, because her love was far greater, she thought, gosh, I'm really fortunate to have God as my son. And then she forgot about it altogether. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur actually gives the example, just like a powerful king who may be ruling millions of people, he has his mother. And his mother knows that he's the king, but she thinks that he is her son. I mean, we all, I think, may have that experience. I'm approaching 50 years old. My mother still thinks I'm her little boy, more or less. Although she knows I'm not also. But it's like that. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives that example, that it's something like that. There's some awareness, but the maternal, the emotion in terms of the different relationships just overwhelms it all. Therefore, matvatmajam. She thought, he is born of my body, so I am his mother. Srila Prabhupada Kedar.